Hey guys, it's Jess here. Wanted to have a quick chat about the vestibular system. I've been having a number of kids lately and some discussions related to them about the vestibular system, particularly talking about how discrimination is different than craving and what we then do about those kids who have issues with vestibular discrimination and craving. I sort of treat them a little bit similarly, but there is a difference. So first, what is the difference between vestibular discrimination and craving? Discrimination is, how we make judgments about that input. How fast am I going? How much distance am I traveling? Which direction am I going in or falling in? It's giving us those details, but it's also telling us, have I had too much? And a lot of our kids tend to seek input to the point of overstimulation. Our cravers, on the other hand, are kids that have a gas tank with a hole in it. So you can keep filling gas in there, but it's never going to be full. So they have this like insatiable appetite for vestibular. They might look somewhat similar on the outside, but typically our kids with discrimination issues are going to have lots of issues with overstimulation. They're the kids that get way over the top silly and start to become unsafe as they get more input. Sometimes what I do, because to me those two are diagnoses, right? Vestibular discrimination and vestibular craving. But then sometimes I also talk about movement seeking, and I'm referring to often in a different way. So I like to think about movement seeking as a symptom, and then I have to figure out why are they seeking movement. So for example, like I said, my cravers will seek movement. They have an insatiable appetite. My kids with discrimination issues will also seek movement. Their appetite, though, is not insatiable. They have definitely a threshold, and when they hit that, they become completely overstimulated and dysregulated, and we have a very hard time coming back down. They usually also have other regulation issues because of their discrimination issues. But then I also have kids who seek movement to regulate their emotions. They might be very anxious and fidgeting because of that. I have kids that seek movement to support their own stability, and when I slow them down, I really see their stability fall apart, or some combination of all of those. So I know we do sometimes use those terms interchangeably, but I'm trying to deliberately separate them because movement seeking doesn't necessarily mean that they are sensory cravers. I feel like in my career, I have seen very many, not very many, true sensory cravers. So first, I want to start with that, just an overview of those different terms and the difference between sensory or vestibular craving and vestibular discrimination. But I mostly want to focus on vestibular discrimination today because I think, in my experience, most of my kids who are big movement seekers tend to have issues more with vestibular discrimination because they have a hard time knowing when they've had enough and they tend to go for too much. So we want to first obviously recognize they're seeking movement. What is the purpose? Are they becoming dysregulated? And then we want to think about how they're getting input. And this has been things that I've been thinking about for a long time, and they're just sort of starting to click for me. So one thing that I always do, my go-to in sessions for a kid who has vestibular discrimination, is to help pace them. We know that movement that is fast and unpredictable and continuous is more likely to overstimulate. It's more alerting. Whereas movement that is rhythmical, predictable, and slower is generally calming and organizing. But like I said, our kids who have discrimination issues tend to seek at a high intensity for far too long and overstimulate themselves. So I then, as the adult, pace the activity. Maybe I'm in charge of the swing and I give them pushes. Or I try to structure the task in a way that gives a natural pause and breaks. That's always my preference because I don't like to insert my control on the session. I want to provide structure that makes the child be successful. So for example, I might turn it into a game where we are going like we're doing 3, 2, 1 blast off or something, right? So I go 3, 2, 1 blast off, and they get this big push, this big intense push, because that's what they want and they're sort of needing and seeking. And then I stop. Oh, our spaceship stopped. We ran out of gas. Let's fill up the gas tank. Whatever. You kind of make something playful. So it's not them waiting, but them playing in a and waiting in a playful way. And then we do a 3-2-1 blast of again. So this is giving that kid big input, big break. Big input, big break, but naturally within this activity. This requires quite a bit of work on the adult's part, however. Or I might be really dramatic and do like a countdown from 10, but really slowly, and or pretend I forgot the number, or, you know, whatever it might be. This is me kind of pacing the activity. That takes a lot of work, and that takes one-on-one support. Once they get to that state of overstimulation, it takes a long time for them to come back down. And usually, I would say in most cases, it takes time and space. You can certainly add in deep pressure, small, quiet space, you know, and empathizing. You might have some other strategies for those kids, but some of those kids that really get dysregulated might just need time, which is hard for therapists and parents, and physical space. They might need you to be giving them some distance. And like I said, this is hard for two reasons. One, the parents coming to you going, aren't you going to help my kid? And two, the therapist is feeling like, I need to help this kid. And it feels like we're doing nothing. So I always will remind the families, sometimes the lack of doing something is our therapeutic response. So me not responding, not providing more auditory information, not adding more demands on this dysregulated, overstimulated child. You know, sometimes that is the therapy that I'm providing. And I'm coaching the parent at the same time so they understand that I'm making a deliberate choice. I'm not just like, oh, crap, I don't know what to do with this kid. I usually will try other things first. Like I said, deep pressure being my usual go-to. That and trying to contain the child without placing, again, physical demands. I might just slowly corral them towards a corner or into a smaller space, or remove movement items out of the room to make that space more successful for them. So you're trying to recognize, and this sometimes takes some trial and error, what input is organizing for them and what input is disorganizing for them. How do we get this child's sensory input that their body does need without overstimulation and with as little adult support as possible? Because like I said, in the sessions, they have one-on-one support with me. So I can do this adult pacing and I can have these structured tasks. And those are great things for the parent to understand and know as a tool. But those kids that tend to get very overstimulated are also very overwhelming for parents because they're in a constant state of dysregulation anytime they are not monitored by an adult. And if you think about your own kids, how often they need to kind of play on their own and self-entertain, these kids escalate and become unsafe, and it turns into utter chaos where the parent then has to intervene, but usually after the fact, which is not as effective, and then everybody's frustrated. So for home strategies, I usually try to figure out how can we get this kid input without overstimulation and with as little adult support as possible. So here are some examples. Any activity that inherently limits its own movement or incorporates deep pressure, those are usually my go-to things. So for example, I have a patient right now who definitely seeks input to the point of overstimulation. And mom has described their house as having like a circular layout where they can kind of basically run in a circle. And this has been an ongoing problem for this family because the kids will run in a circle until they get overstimulated. And then it's crashing and flopping and not safe behavior and overstimulation that then requires adult support and lots of time to recover. Which is stressful on everybody because the parents then feel like they have to implement strategies that they feel like are distressful, like removing the kids, putting them in their bedrooms to settle down, and that generally lead to self-esteem and guilt issues in the kids because they start to recognize, I'm not doing what's expected, I'm not being appropriate, but I literally cannot stop myself. It's like a train going too fast and it can't stop. And that's those kids. And they start to feel it. And then the kid, you know, the parents recognize that this is problematic and also problematic for the child. So, you know, there are certain things we know that the kids like to do around this. You're not going to obviously be able to block off this space very easily. But we also know there are certain things that they do that get them really, really revved up. We know running for sure, right? Because they can run pretty fast and it can be pretty uncontrolled. Their body is not contained in any way. But they also sometimes will try to push like little toy shopping carts, but same thing. They're running and it gets crazy and they're crashing into stuff. In the clinic, we had been playing around sometimes with like the little bikes, like the excavator toy or the ride-on toys. We've played around with scooter boards and them, you know, going on the carpet on their belly. These kids could go, and I always have the sister in the session, so these kids could go and do that on their own for several minutes without this escalation. I could talk to the parent and not have to intervene. While at the same time, if they were on the swing together, it was, I couldn't get three words out before I had to intervene to slow them down or address safety concerns. So I knew swing and this kind of uncontrolled movement is just way too much, which that's not surprising because that's, like I said, most of our discrimination kids. But on the flip side, these activities that inherently limited movement and gave proprioceptive input were okay, at least in small doses. Now, granted, maybe they couldn't do that for like an hour on their own, but if they can do it for 5 minutes, that's a huge amount of progress for them. So these little bikes, they can't physically move very fast. Their body is stuck in one spot because they're on the bike, and their muscles are having to work really hard to propel it on carpet especially. So it was inherently regulating and still allowed them to get movement. Mm-hmm. Same with the scooter board. But like I told the mom, I said, they're doing this on carpet, which is resistive. This would not work well at home in that space you described because it was hardwood and they're going to go too fast. And then you're going to have uncontrolled movement. We also talked about, you know, these kids really struggle when they need movement. So these are kids that need movement for regulation, but also seek to that point of overstimulation. It's winter time. It's freezing out. Half the time you can't go outside, or it gets dark early. There's a lot more limitations. They're not going to playgrounds. And this is usually how they were getting a lot of that input, right? And in a space where parents felt a little bit better controlled. You know, usually if you're taking your kids to a playground, you also aren't trying to do other things, so you can be more focused on the kids. And also they're outside, so it feels a little bit less chaotic than when they're running around like a bunch of maniacs inside the house. So I said, you're not getting this input. On top of this, when I was having this conversation with the parents, they also had been quarantined for the last couple weeks at home because of COVID, so they were really feeling cooped up. So I said, we have to find ways to get these kids input that they need in more appropriate ways. So the other way that we talked about were car rides, because again, movement in a car is rhythmical, predictable. It's linear as well. We're not, you know, spinning around in circles, hopefully. And our bodies are contained. They have to be generally in a car seat or buckled up. And it's not like in a forced way, you know, like we wouldn't want to take a kid who's dysregulated and like pin them down and force them to sit with us or anything like that. But this is like a very normal expectation that you sit in the car. So a lot of kids will do great with that. And when the weather's bad, that might be a good way to just like, let's go out for a drive. Granted, that is going to take adult intervention, but if they're really needing support, that was a way to do it. But otherwise, we talked about doing these tasks that they could mostly do on their own. So the other option that we looked at was they have these little cars that they like to push around, which require them to be on their knees pushing them. So if they're going to be pushing them, they're on their hands and knees pushing them. So now we're getting extra proprioceptive input, and our movement is inherently limited because we cannot go very fast on our hands and knees like we can on our feet. So then mom can at least say, okay, you guys can play with this little car. You can play with these little bikes. You can play with, you know, this scooter downstairs on the carpet. But we're not going to play with the shopping cart and we're not going to run. So they had some ways that they could structure these activities where they could get more input without the parent having to supervise. Certainly there are times they're going to have to supervise, but we need the parent to also be able to have breaks so they can regulate and then be available for other adult pacing. The other thing you can think about with these kids is the benefit of therapeutic listening. So I have had pretty good success with these types of kiddos who are big movement seekers. Grape Jams is a great go-to because it does have a lot of low-frequency sounds, which activates both the proprioceptive and vestibular systems. So that's kind of my go-to for my kids who are big sensory seekers. They may benefit with that from that, either in the sessions or as like a home program. Usually I do that as a home program. But I would say especially for our kids who also have other auditory issues in addition to this movement seeking, whether that be, you know, they're sensitive to auditory, they have auditory discrimination issues or auditory figure ground issues or spatial awareness issues. Those kids especially seem to do really well with therapeutic listening from a regulation standpoint. I might then do a different music selection. So if you have a kiddo that has sensitivity to auditory or, like I said, discrimination, figure ground, or spatial awareness issues, I might do a different music selection than Grape Jams, but never hurts to at least try that. So those are some things to think about if you've got those kids that just seem to go absolutely wild when movement is introduced. Those are some things that you can maybe practice in your sessions or do some trial and error in your sessions to then better educate and provide support to the family.